Ryan Rashad from TSN was working the game last night. Shotter, first of all, I've put out calls to the NHL. I've talked to some GMs and people. They were surprised by this format. Most people thought it was just a crossover 5-4 from the Pacific to the Central or vice versa if they were higher. They didn't think that automatically the best team would play the lowest-seeded wild card, even if they were in their division. Do you think this will change next year?
Yeah, I mean, I think... if the GMs make enough noise about anything, it'll change. So, yeah, I think that there's a deficiency in the system, as you pointed out. And, it needs to be a benefit to finish first and to have an unbelievable year. And it has to be, no matter what, it's a benefit to you. So, if there's a significant issue there and enough people make noise, it changes. That's the NHL has shown they're not unwilling to make changes mid-stride.
Give me your thoughts on the game last night.
Yeah, well, I think there was a lot of pressure on the Oilers last night to come out and have a turn-it-around kind of performance. And I think a number of facets of their game, they did, but in a couple of important ones, they didn't. The penalty kill wasn't very good. I think there were a couple that Ben Scrivens probably would have liked to have had back. But I thought the first probably 25, 27 minutes of the game for the Oilers it was pretty good. I thought 5-on-5, they were certainly close to the better team. And you could say San Jose coming off a game the night before looked dead, which they did. But you have to give the Oilers credit. That's still a good team. So I think early on in the game, they looked pretty good. The 5-on-5 game was in order. I thought Taylor Hall bounced back nicely and had a good effort. He was a dangerous-looking player for the first period and a half. I thought Perron was good and everything seemed to be going real well, and then the refs didn't do them any favors, the veteran players didn't do them any favors, and then the wheels fell completely off and there was no digging out after going down like that to that team. So tough play by Petrie, tough one on Scrivens, and the game's over.
Yeah, that the decision by Petrie with less than a minute to go in the second period, you just eventually, you know, that has to be something that the players just get out of their game. And I don't know, you know, I wonder at what point do you look and say, okay, there's inexperience, and then there's just an unwillingness or ability to do what it takes to compete every night at the NHL?
Yeah, well, do you remember, Dallas dealt with Petrie on this earlier this year, if you remember. There were some bad, bad mistakes happening, and Petrie ended up sitting. It was a healthy scratch for, I can't remember if it was one or two games. So Dallas has tried to crack the whip. The issue is, if they don't have Petrie in right now, between Fraser and Larson, having to play those guys regular minutes, they just don't have good enough players to go in and still give the Oilers a chance to win games. They just don't have good enough options. So I'm not sure if benching guys in game would be smarter. The problem is, when Dallas looks down his bench, Petrie still gives him his best chance to go out and play a shift even based on what else he's looking at. It's just not a deep enough defense to have the luxury of trying to sit guys and bench guys. And it's not like they've got super high-end players banging the door down to get into these spots. They just don't. They flat out don't. So it's a tough position because you need to keep winning games to keep morale up. Yet the guys who were supposed to be part of the solution continue to be part of the problem. So what do?
Ryan Rashad from TSN joins us. Ryan, is the biggest weakness of the organization their inability to evaluate veteran NHL defensemen? Because if you look at Marinchin and Klefbom and Nurse, that's an amateur scouting. That's not your pro scout or anybody else. I can't recall the last time they brought in a defenseman who was a good, solid contributing defenseman in Edmonton.
Yeah, for a long period of time. You could make the argument that although it didn't end well, they squeezed a good year and a bit out of Ryan Whitney. I thought when they brought in Vigenovsky, they got some decent play out of him. That didn't end fantastic either in the trade that ended up being for Whitney. So, yeah, I would say that pro scouting has been an issue. I think that's probably fair to say. I think that when you look at some of the free agent signings over the years, that's where your pro scouts sit there and give their recommendations or not. That's where they fill your ear full of, this is the deal with this guy, this is the deal with that guy. And I'll preface this by saying I thought it was a good summer for him. But when you look at Ben Eager and you look at Eric Belanger, you look at that off season, the Darcy Hordichuk, you kind of, at the time, you felt like it was okay. Those guys all played. We didn't see them a ton. And it turned out they were, at least the two of them, were just an absolute disaster. And that's on the pro scouts to kind of have an understanding of where these guys are at in their careers, what they look like night to night, what they're hearing behind the scenes. I mean, it's all part of their jobs to gather professional intelligence, give good educated opinions on guys, and help the GM find good players, right? So I do think the pro scouting has been an issue. I think that's fair to say. And, I'm not sure what... Like, if you watch that one episode of Oil Change, I know there's so many things we don't see behind the scenes, and that show only puts certain segments on and stuff. But if you look at a trade deadline, Craig was sitting there asking, you know, what do you think of this player? They're evaluating a player, and Dallas had just looked at five or six shifts of the guy and said, well, he's probably an upgrade based on what I'm seeing, but that's just five or six shifts. And Craig McTavish said, well, we'll revisit it in the summer when we know more of what we've got. It was almost like, and the way it looked was that there was a level of indecision and a lack of information. And at times that show behind the scenes has kind of indicated similar things, and it doesn't look great. Now, it's small snippets, but that's supposed to be what those guys are good at, knowing exactly everything there is to know about all these players, have an up-to-date intelligence and an opinion on things. And if that's not there, then there's a problem. I'm not sure if it is or not.
Well, it definitely looks like a concern. I think yeah. We both agree on that one. And, you know, Craig McTavish has another huge offseason where I just don't think it's realistic to believe he can fill all the holes in one summer. If he only can fill two, which two do you think are the most realistic to fill?
Well, I think he needs to add a top four defenseman. Absolutely, he has to add a top four defenseman. And then I think they need to decide what they're doing at the number two center spot. I think they kind of need to figure out if what they're doing with Sam here. I'm not sure how committed they are to him long-term in that spot. So if there's an opportunity to put a different type of player in that number two center spot and whether you move Sam along or have designs on bumping him to the wing, whatever it looks like, a top four defenseman and a number two center are probably pretty critical on their must-do list, I would say.
No, but do you think they're realistic?
Well, I mean, we've seen teams add several quality players in the off season. I don't think it's impossible to go and do. I don't think that it's out of this world. But I think it's how desperate you are versus the opportunity you have. Like, I guarantee you, when he's standing there talking with Paul Holmgren about Braden Coburn, and Paul Holmgren is saying whatever price he's saying, which we've heard was 3 second-round picks, but... that in the back of his mind, a big part of whether he pulls that trigger or not is how he feels about his own defense. And I think at times, Craig and a lot of managers that have come through have tended to over-evaluate their own players, have tended to over-evaluate just what those players truly are. And I would venture a guess that he's sitting there thinking Petrie can probably do this. I know Craig has always been pretty high on Jeff Petrie and thought pretty highly of him, and while he's listening to the price of Braden Coburn, he's probably thinking in the back of his mind, you know, Petrie, like a similar type of player, can't he do that? But I think he overestimated, and Braden Coburn would have come here and been a top pairing defenseman. So I think they need to have a real realistic view of what they have, an understanding of how long it's going to take the young players to develop into what they need, and just pay the price and go get it. I mean, it's going to cost you something, but you have to go and do it. Otherwise, I mean, if they wait for Darnell Nurse and Martin Marincin and Oscar Klefbom to be able to drive the bus on this defense, they'll be waiting 3 years minimum. So you can't do that. Something needs to be done. A veteran needs to be found. The defense needs to be improved immediately so that they're on the same curve as the forwards, which are a group of young guys that they're not in their first couple of years in the league. With the right parts around them, the hope for the Oilers would be that they're ready to win in the next few years with these guys maturing. But you can't wait for this blue line. They're too young.
Brian Rashad from TSN. Are you, when you look at Lander and Pitlick, how do you think they have played, and have they done enough to be noticed by the organization to think, okay, these are guys we're going to like in the future?
Yeah, I think that I think Anton Lander's game is going to take a long time to round into form. I do. I think there is a player there. I think there is a leader there. But I think it's going to take a little while for Anton Lander's game at the NHL level to round into shape. And I think they're going to have to just stick with him for a while and let it happen. His game at the minors, he's more of a point producer in the minors. He's having all kinds of troubles producing at the NHL level. I think they need to be patient with the points and allow him to just play a real solid two-way game at the NHL level. And I think they have designs on Lander developing into their third-line center. So as Boyd Gordon's contract comes close to expiring, then all of a sudden they feel they have a guy that will be able to slide into that spot. I'd be patient with Lander, and I'd continue to give him opportunity because I don't think he necessarily kills you. Pitlick, similar to Pitlick in that I think if Pitlick's on your fourth line next year or at times maybe on your third line, depending on what else they've got, I do think that he could potentially be in the plans because I think he's going to be, and more than anything, he's going to be at a price point that just makes complete sense. You have to have guys on your roster who make less than $1 million. You do. You have to have a couple of forwards who are under that $1 million mark who you get some value out of. You can't go out and fill every spot with a 28-year-old on his third contract making 1.6 or 1.8 or Matt Hendricks kind of money. You just can't do that. So you need room for the Landers and Pitlicks.
Quickly looking out east, Toronto, Detroit, Columbus, Washington, all four teams have 80 points, depending on which team it is, anywhere between 8 and 10 games left in the season. Which two make it, which two don't?
Well, I mean, look, the way Toronto's going, you can't. I don't know how you'd pick Toronto to pull out of this tailspin and make it. I just don't know how anybody could realistically think they're going to be able to pull it together and make it. So, you know, in Washington or Detroit's just been killed with injuries and such the whole way. So, I mean, if I think it'd be great for Columbus to make it. You know, I think that they're 5-4-1 in their last 10. They're playing decent hockey. Detroit's in and around that same clip. So, you know, I think Detroit finds a way to squeak in and keep their streak alive.
What about the Capitals? Are they like the hardest team in the NHL to get a read on?
Yeah, aren't they? It's they really are. And I won't profess to watch a ton of their hockey, but you look at their roster and you feel like they should have more than enough to be there. But it's kind of, for some reason, they just are floating around that zone where they're not, you know, they give up a fair number of goals and they're one of those teams that's a little bit of a frustrating enigma for its fans, I would imagine, because they have one of the game's great stars, yet they aren't able to consistently be there every year the way some other teams are that have that similar caliber star.
And did you happen to see the stories in the OHL where the goaltender, and this is the second time I think in the last year, it happened once in college, you know, where the goalie just leaves the ice in the middle of a game. What did you think of that?
I saw the headline and read through it. Now, it was 8 goals he got lit up for, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And then he got pulled and he just left the bench?
Yeah, and then Bob Bugner, well, from what he was, I'm not going to say it was a Patrick Waugh, but it kind of looked like a Patrick Waugh.
Yeah, like why was he left in for 8 goals? What did they have? What else did they have? Did they have their normal backup or did they have... Like for any goalie, I mean, no matter what, you don't walk away from your team. You don't walk away from them and leave them and not be there with them. Be mad, be frustrated, be even chirp if you feel like you have to. But you sit down there next to your team and you go through the rest of that game. They're every bit as embarrassed as you are. So I don't agree in any circumstance with a guy leaving his team in a bad loss like that because of personal frustration.
Well, yeah, I just find it interesting that we've seen this now twice in the last year. So I'm just curious. Definitely, I don't think the one thing you want to see on a continual basis showed up. But hey, you know what? Everybody's why is the goalie, and here's the thing I've always understood. So the defenseman and the forwards can keep playing a game if they're down 8-0, but somehow the goalie's that special that he gets, you know, the night off. I've never understood that. Hey, if everybody says the goalie's the same equal part of the team, if they're struggling and he's letting some bad goals and the defense is making mistakes, then you win and you lose as a team together. That's my philosophy.
Well, yeah, and to put yourself ahead of the team and say what I'm going through right now is so much worse than what everybody else is going through, and so I have the right to just extricate myself from this embarrassment. It's like, nah, no. You need to sit there and eat this with the rest of them, and while you might have reason to be frustrated at your coach, you take that up with him. But to just buckle on your teammates like that and leave them hanging out there, I mean, it's one thing to go down the tunnel and maybe have a bit of a hissy fit and gather yourself so that you're not doing it on the bench for everybody to see for a minute and a half or so, 90 seconds, whatever. We see that sometimes. Goalie will leave and then come back. That I understand. That's, you're just trying to have good decorum and not put on a show, but to just leave all together is no good at all.
Shaga, we will talk to you on Friday.
Okay, buddy. Have a great one.